Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by, you guessed it, the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool, unique hotel that's super kitschy and just recently remodeled and is close to everything. It's just right around the corner from Second City. It's not only improviser, but it's pet friendly as well. Check out Hotel Lincoln, the official hotel of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Rich Tellerico. He is currently a writer on Comedy Central's Key and Peele. He's also written for Mad TV, Saturday Night Live, and The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Rich is not only a writer, he's also an improviser and a teacher, and you can catch him playing with Bob Dassey and Craig Kakowski in the wonderful Dorisky. We talked to him about his first improv teacher, which was Stephen Colbert, also how Rich likes to start an improv scene, and what it's like writing on Key and Peele. So in this episode, which I promise you'll hear it in about 2 minutes, I will not go long-winded on this, Rich mentions how he first knew Key and Peele, Jordan and Keegan, here in Chicago when they were starting out, and then how later they all meet up again when they're hired for Mad TV. And it just reminds me of something that's really important, and that is don't be a jerk, because people will remember. And on the flip side, people will remember if you're a nice person as well. And I think about all the people that I've been lucky enough to interview for Improv Nerd over the last 2 years. Andy Richter, Jeff Garland, Dave Koechner, Matt Besser. Now, I've known those guys going back 20 years, probably even more, 25 years, here in Chicago. And certainly, it's because I had some talent. I'm not going to play the old low self-esteem card, which I think I probably overplay. It's just part of my shtick. But I think it was also because they liked me and I was a nice guy. And so if you're taking your first improv class, or you're on a house team somewhere, or if you're working at one of the big comedy theaters, you are networking. If you know it or not, you are networking. And people will remember if you're a good person or if you're a jerk. So if you take anything from this episode, anything at all, take this. Don't be a jerk. I think you're really going to enjoy this. Rich Tellerico, we call it the Rich Tellerico episode. Here it is.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's 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 a nerd. He's a nerd.
I got this good. It's working now. We're really excited to have you on the program.
Thank you, Jimmy. I'm a fan of the show, and I'm very happy to be here.
And you came in all the way from L.A.
That's right. Cleared the schedule, and I am here.
Great, and this thing is working. Okay, so let's go back to 19 years old. Okay, you're 19 years old. You dropped out of community college. You were doing stand-up at a nightclub that was owned by a high school art teacher.
Yes.
What made you try stand-up?
The first experience I had with stand-up comedy was I was in the high school musical.
High school musical?
In my school, which was called Bye Bye Birdie. Uh-huh. And I was Mr. McAfee, who was like a ridiculous character. I think Paul Lynde plays him in the film. And as if these are comparable. Right. And I was always kind of joking around in school, and I didn't know it had an application outside of that. Until four friends of mine who were in a rock band called Chaos, and they spelled it K-A-O-S, which is kick ass on stage, invited me. They were going to do a little rock show at the high school, and they said, why don't you get up and tell some jokes before we do it? And I said, okay. I was 16, so I stole a bunch of jokes and went up there and did them, and it was really fun. And I went to my high school art teacher, who I knew had a nightclub, and in my idiocy, I was like, hey, what if I told some jokes at your nightclub? And he goes, I love it, let's do it. And his name was Tellerico, although he spelled it differently than mine. And it kind of started from there. And then there was also a nightclub in Utica, New York called, it was like called the Bahama Beach Club or something. And on Wednesday nights, they had a stand-up show. And I would also go sneak into that.
What kind of stuff did you do besides stealing from other people? Do you remember?
Well, the first few times I stole from other people, I'm sure, and just kind of like, or told jokes that I had heard. And I think eventually I tried to tell some original material. It's going back a long ways, but it was like corny stuff, like, you know, I came from a broken home, the whatever, the plumbing didn't work. I don't know, just stupid stuff like that. And then the guy that hosted the show at this nightclub was the owner of the club, this other place, and he was petrified. He had to keep bringing up the acts, and he was terrible at it, and he was awful.
The art teacher?
No, this was a different... Sorry, okay. There's another nightclub over there, but this guy was awful at it, and I just asked him, I said, hey, do you want me to, you know, help you host the show? He goes, yes. So I got to...
Please.
So I got to bring up the comics, but I was up there, like, you know, 5 minutes a week, you know, every week, and I also learned some magic so I could help fill out my 5 minutes. And I would do magic tricks and things like that. You know, the poured milk into the whatever, and torn and restored newspaper, and things like that.
And then, you're also doing some acting at the time, and you were an extra in a film that was shooting in Utica, New York, not far from where you grow up.
Right.
And then, you meet somebody on that set, and things change.
Yes. Well, I had my girlfriend at the time said, you know what? There's a thing in the newspaper, like a 2-line blurb about some short film that they're shooting. And this guy was from Second City here in Chicago. He'd done the touring company, and he was from Utica, which is near where I grew up. And he was doing a short film there and needed extras. So I got there at like 6 a.m. and I was there well before everybody. And I waited till the absolute end of the day so I could talk to the guy. You know, who now I know is just another dope like me making films. You know,
right.
But I said, hey, what can you recommend?
And it was Dave Sinker.
It was
right?
Dave Sinker.
I know Dave, yeah.
Very cool guy. Mm-hmm. And he has a theater out here in the Burbs now, right?
Yeah, called The Comedy Shrine Aurora.
Yeah, very cool guy. I'm still in touch with him. But he happened to remember the number for Second City off the top of his head. He goes, yeah, it's 664-4032. Give him a call. And I was like, okay. And
now, you don't know anything about Second City at this time.
No, I barely remembered SCTV. I didn't watch a lot of that as a kid. I kind of knew what that was. I didn't understand what Second City was. I didn't even really know what improv was. I knew it was like comedy, but with more people. You know? and I called Second City, and that was in August of 92. I had just turned 19. They sent me a brochure. October of 92, I was living in Chicago. And took my first class then.
Now, how did you, you know, because knowing you when you were here, you always had such confidence. And I'm thinking, at 19, there's no way I could have done what you did. How did you have that confidence back then to do that?
It was ignorance, Jimmy.
Really?
Sheer ignorance. I think so. And, you know, just feeling finally like connecting to something. All through school, like I was a very poor high school student because I didn't really connect to those things. And I liked goofing around. So this was like organized goofing around, and like, you know, people would let you, would listen to you, like adults would respond to you on stage, you know, just doing early improv scenes. So I think it was a lot of ignorance, you know, just the fact that I was hopeful to be here, I guess.
When you came here, not knowing what Second City was, what did you want to accomplish?
My original goal was to take the year-long classes at Second City and then return triumphantly to upstate New York and apply what I learned.
Because it only takes a year to master it.
Right.
Yeah.
Moment to learn, a year to master.
All right, and so then you get into a class. Here it's the IFA program, which was Improv for Actors.
Yes.
How did you end up with Improv for Actors? How did you end up in that class?
The way it worked back then, this was, I think Second City didn't have like these sub-level lettered levels. It was like this Improv for Actors class, and then level one, to level six, and that was the conservatory in 1992.
And who was your first teacher?
Stephen Colbert was my first teacher. And I took, I don't know, should I get into that, taking the first class?
Yeah.
So I took the first class with Stephen, and it's a class that prepares you for the training center. So after the class, you audition, and then based on that audition, you get into the training center. After the first audition, I took the 8-week class, everybody except me and my two scene partners got into the thing. And I was like, oh, wow. So I went to Martin DeMott, who was running the training center.
Who was a great teacher.
Yes, God bless, rest his soul. Mm-hmm. He said, why don't you retake Stephen's class and audition again, you'll be fine.
Why don't you retake Stephen's class and audition again?
And he said, So I did that, and then this time I auditioned, and this time everybody except me got in. And I was like, oh no, and I knew because the letter was light, they send you a letter. I was like, oh no, there's not enough paper in here. And I was kind of crushed, and it also blew my plan because it was going to take me, if I was going to finish, it was going to take me more
They didn't than a understand year. It. Had they known that, maybe they would have made an exception.
I was in a timeline, Jimmy.
Right, right.
And so I retook, and then Steven said, why don't you take class at Improv Olympia, which is what they were calling Improv Olympic.
Because when I started, it was Improv Olympic, and then they got into the, what happened with something with the Olympic Committee, so Sharna Halperin, who runs it, she changed it to Improv Olympia, and then of course now it's IO Chicago. But you were in the Improv Olympia phase.
Yes. And
which you only referred, you will not refer to IO Chicago, it's Improv Olympia.
Yes, and I won't pretend I don't know what you're talking about.
Right, yeah.
Until you say it right. No, just sidebar, what about like the Olympic Deli in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Why are they picking on this theater? I don't get it.
I think there was a more, they were, dry cleaners and delis were protected.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right.
So Colbert says go to I.O. Mm-hmm. And how was that?
It was cool. It was like finding out there's another room behind the room that you were in. You know, I was like, oh, this is a secret panel here, and there's a whole other community of people here. You know, I didn't understand these other theaters and what they were about, and you know, they were teaching out of the School Street Theater space, and it was just really run down, and you know, it was like, you know, just holes in the wall, and
it was down in a basement, as I remember.
Yeah, and but I remember being excited about it. And liking it, so I don't
know. And I heard you said that you really found your voice there, or you really felt comfortable there. What was it that you weren't getting at Second City that you got at I.O.?
Well, Colbert's a shitty teacher.
Right.
I'm joking. I think the way that I was interpreting what was being taught to me was that there was rules, things you should not do. Don't do this. Don't ask questions. Don't... whatever, you know, all the don'ts. And I always had this sense that like a game show buzzer was gonna go off when I was, you know, auditioning or performing for them. And the way Improv Olympic was teaching it, you know, and I took Sharna and Kevin Dorff's class, mm-hmm. and then eventually Dell, I just felt like the world was more open. And it just felt like they were teaching probably the same rules, but maybe with a slightly different spin, or maybe that's the way I was interpreting it, but it felt better for me.
What was your experience of working with Dell?
You know, I caught him at the tail end of his, well, the semi-tail end. And, you know, to summarize the whole thing, I guess I wish I took more advantage of him when I was with him. But I felt like he told me things that sometimes I remember. He told me one night that a comedian's job is to experience strange things and report back to the rest of the world.
Which he did.
Yeah, which he did. So, I don't know, I guess it's like there's this flag planted with him as like the king of your teachers, you know, and he's kind of the overall guiding voice, I suppose. And sometimes we'll even say that to each other, you know, like, well, or I might say that to myself, like, oh, let's pretend Dell's watching this, and let's try to do the kind of thing that would impress him. Because if you impressed him, you did it.
What did you learn from Colbert that you still use?
Oh, thank you. Yes, in fact, I started teaching my own class a few years ago, and I thought, I'm so great. I thought of this awesome thing, and I was like, oh yeah, that's what Colbert told me. So I'd kind of been adopting a thing that he said in the very first class I ever took with him, which was do, feel, say.
And what did he mean by that?
To try to connect using your object work to something, to understand how you feel about it, and then speak from point of view that you've discovered through this object work.
Give me an example.
It comes down to the way I've used it in my class is to get the players to compliment each other physically first. So that way you get all the heavy lifting of who they are and where they are out of the way. Because teachers always say, you got to get the who, what, and where out in your first line of dialogue, which I kind of don't agree with because it puts the pressure on you to narrate what's going on as opposed to be experiencing it. The difference being like you're not Mark Twain telling the story, you're Jim on the raft. You know, it's different. Narrating it or being in it are different. So I use complimentary moves in my class all the time to get players to create something together. So you might come out and shoot pool. And then I would come out and compliment you and put a drink on the pool table and you do the shot. And now we've together discovered who and where we are and what's going on, right? We're in the 16th Street Pool Hall. Your name must be Ace. I'm the bartender, Marty, and that's your motorcycle out front, right? But if I complimented you differently, let's say you're shooting pool and I come out and vacuum, now you're terrible and we're in a suburban basement somewhere. So using these complementary moves, A plus B doesn't equal AB, A plus B equals C, and that discovery is the improv part. So it's a lot about making a distinction between improv, discovery versus invention. Because I could come out and lay out a premise and lay out everything with a line of dialogue, but it had nothing to do with discovery. But if we work together to create it with the physicals, then you've actually improvised.
How does that differ from the UCB style, which is writing on their feet? They're all about the game. How does that approach differ?
Well, I have never taken a class at UCB, but Ali Farinakian was a coach of mine. Matt Besser was a coach of mine. And I think that's kind of a negative term, writing on their feet. I don't know, because I remember from Besser's he didn't love that.
But no.
I do feel like it's different in that, you know, and again, I wouldn't even characterize it as a UCB thing, because I do know they do organic stuff too. I feel like it's what I would call the flamethrower approach to starting a scene, which is where one person comes out and says everything everyone needs to know. And I'm like, great, when does the improv start? Because this guy just came out and said what it's all about. So the improv is the discovery that happens when two sticks rub together to start the fire. You do something, I do something, and now the group mind, which includes the audience, is created because we both, participated in this physical. And it's slightly different in that way.
You mentioned the group mind with the audience. Mm-hmm. A lot of performers, I know I have this sometimes, we'll come off stage and we'll blame the audience, or we won't, or we'll say they weren't as respectful, they weren't as receptive as they usually are. Where are they in the group mind process? How do we include them more?
Well, this goes to a Billy Wilder thought that says,
Wilder, the director of Partner,
That he says the audience wants to add up 2 + 2. They'll love you for it. They want to do that. They want to be involved in the process. So the audience is involved in the group mind in the sense that they're making the assumptions along with the players. Improv players work with safe assumptions. That's what you use. So then the audience is doing that too. Too many creative left turns and too many wild justifications, you shake the audience loose. They can't follow you anymore. You know what I mean? So if we're just safely assuming, oh, okay, well, if he's shooting pool and I'm putting a drink down, we must be in a bar. And that is just a safe assumption. As opposed to, making it some ridiculous reason and you give me some crazy gift. So the audience is making those safe assumptions with you. They're not creative and clever as much, I should say, as we can be. So it's almost, and that goes to a Keith Johnstone thing of the more original an improviser tries to appear, the less so they will appear. So just using safe assumption and, getting two sticks to rub together and kind of create something, organically from scratch or whatnot, I guess.
So let's get back a little to your life here. So you eventually get into the conservatory after auditioning two times. Then you get hired by the touring company, Second City.
No.
You did not get hired by the touring company.
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. Well,
I'm kind of jumping.
Oh, you're jumping.
I'm jumping, yes. Then you get hired by the touring company. It takes you three times, right? And you give up at this point.
Yes, I auditioned with all my friends at that point. And one of my good friends, Bill Cott, I think you know.
Yeah, hilarious.
Hilarious guy. He was in my first Colbert class, and he took time off so that I would catch up with him, so that we could do our final student show together. We do our student show, and then Bill auditions and gets into Second City, and all my friends start auditioning in the first year that we all audition, and I had nothing. I didn't even think I got a call back. So I waited a year for the touring company audition, and in the meantime, I was doing stuff at I.O. And then I auditioned a second time, didn't get in, and after the third time, I didn't get in, and I was like, okay, I guess that's it. I'm not going to work at Second City. So I took a job as a stand-in on a horror film. Called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, Part 2.
Who was the original director of that movie? Was it
John McNaughton.
Okay.
And then the director of the second movie was Chuck Perillo.
Okay.
Who I'm Facebook friends with.
Okay.
but, Neil McNamara and I were the two stand-ins. Improv guys, because Susie Gardner got put that together.
Okay.
So two improv guys are the stand-ins for the two leads in a very dramatic film. We look just like them. And actually, Neil McNamara and myself We're standing in for Neil Giantoli, who was playing Henry, and Rich Komenick, who was playing the side part. So it was Neil and Rich and Neil and Rich. And we were always kind of dressed alike and hanging around, but there was like serious Neil and Rich and then goofball Neil and Rich.
Were you guys just doing bits?
Nonstop. Okay. And we ate nonstop. I gained like 30 pounds. Neil had to go to a wedding and his suit didn't fit at the end of the shoot because all we did was eat craft services and make nonstop jokes. And
did you ever get reprimanded?
Yeah, and the director was always shooting us dirty looks, and getting pissed. And
you're making like $80 a day, right?
Which was a pretty good, for me, I loved it. It was $75 a day, but we made more than the film loader, which I never understood. Right. It's like, this guy has the most important job. If he screws up, the whole day's ruined.
Right.
You know, anyway, so I'm sorry. You got to keep me on track.
Okay, you're there. You had given up on getting into Second City,
yes,
Touring Company. Yes.
Yeah, and then my friend Bill Cott, who was in Blue Co., one of the touring companies at the time, got hired by the Dana Carvey Show. To go be a player on that with Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell, mm-hmm, and obviously Dana Carvey. And then I got offered a position to understudy for Bill. And Kelly Leonard had called me and said, do you want to come in and understudy Blue Co.? And I got to understudy them on a ski tour, which was a 3-week tour. And I was such an idiot. I brought, we were going to be gone for 18 days, so I brought 18 pairs of underwear. And 18 pairs of socks, 18 pants, and as opposed to doing laundry like everyone else, you know. And I'm like walking through the airport like, oh my God. So anyway, and then by the end of that tour, I found out that I got into the company and I toured with them for about a year.
And then you got the ETC.
Yeah, and then Brian Stack had left ETC.
Brian Stack, who goes on to write for Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, I took over for him there.
And then here's an interesting thing. You get an offer and you go to New York to write for Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
How old are you at this time?
This was 1998, so I was 26.
Okay, so you'd been in Chicago for about 7 years, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, you get this offer and you decide to turn it down.
Yes, because it was the year Horatio got hired.
Horatio Sands.
I forget what else happened that year. Dratch, I think, was that year. She was later. I went out and I met with them, and Adam McKay was the head writer at the time, and
Tina hired by then or not?
I don't know.
Did you meet with Lauren or Michael Schumacher?
I think I met with Schumacher.
Okay.
Schumacher. I don't know what it was, Jimmy. I think I got out there and I was like, I didn't expect anybody to even read what I turned in.
You would put a packet together.
Yeah, because
how did you decide to put a, just, it was a lark.
Well, everybody was doing it. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, okay, I'll do one of those. I thought it was part of the process. But at the time, we had been writing a lot. We did a thing for Second City, a radio show that aired in the suburbs only out here for a while. And we actually had a very short-lived television show with the Farley brothers, Kevin and John Farley, Chris's brothers. So I had been writing a lot of stuff. So I just put some stuff together, and then I went and met with them, and then I found out I got it, and I was like, I don't think I want to do it, because I also wanted to be an actor. I was like, well, I don't want to be a writer, you know? And I wanted to do Second City main stage, which I hadn't done.
But you weren't guaranteed that you were going to get main stage.
No.
How'd you make that decision? Did you go and talk to Kelly and say, I've been offered this, am I going to do main stage?
I think all I really remember was maybe calling Adam and saying, I'm so sorry, I just don't think it's the right time, or something like that. I don't remember the second
Did you agonize over that decision?
I don't think so. I think I knew I was doing something wrong or wasn't great, but I also just felt like, I don't know, Second City was very important to me at that time, because once you see it, you're like, I want to do that. I want to do the Second City. I want to put up a
show. Do you regret turning that down?
No. And the thing was, I wanted to go through the Second City process, because in the ETC, I really wasn't a part of that writing process. I filled in for Stack halfway through. They were also doing construction on the theater at the time, so it was just like pure chaos. And I wanted that process. You know, the Second City writing process is a very luxurious thing for the performers, because it's 5 days a week. You've got all day to dream of things and put them up and come up with stuff and improvise. So I wanted that experience. So
were people in the improv community coming up to you and going, well, I can't believe you turned that down?
I don't know how many people knew about it.
Why keep it such a secret? You know, we've had people on the show who've been hired or had interest, and people, there's like a secretness about it.
You know, honestly, Jimmy, I don't know who knew what and all that. I just knew that, I just remember it kind of coming and going, and then on to the next thing. And I didn't feel bad about it, because I also didn't it wasn't appealing to me. I was like, I don't want to write.
Because at that point, you wanted to be an actor.
I was. I mean, right. In my mind, I was, yeah. So I don't know. I guess that
because I, when I look back at that, I thought, my God, you would have been here 7 years, and you got a huge. I mean, that's a huge compliment.
Thank you. Well, you know, I think it was the right place at right time. Adam also knew who I was, and he was the head writer. So if that wasn't the case, would my packet have blown the doors off of 30 Rock? Probably not. I mean, it was. I showed a competency, and he knew me as a funny person. So. You know, I'm sure it was a lot of that too. You know.
Then you do main stage, mm-hmm. couple. Then you do a couple shows there. Mm-hmm. You leave, and Mad TV comes, and this time they offer you a writing job.
I know these writing jobs.
Right.
Well, at that point, I had left Second City. I quit Second City in the summer of 2001, and
on good terms.
Well, I thought so, but it was there was a writing process that had just started. And you know in an improv scene, when someone goes, well, and you realize you just missed the edit?
Yeah.
I felt like I just missed the edit on leaving Second City. I felt like I should have left before this process started. And I thought I was catching it at the right time, but I just missed it. It was like 2 weeks into the writing process. And I think this was the beginning of, you know, me maybe pissing off Second City with, because I think Kelly and Andrew were both upset that I left right when the process had started, because it could probably was jarring, you know.
So you were 2 weeks in the process.
Yes, and the director was not having an easy time of it.
Who was the director?
Nameless for now.
Okay.
He did not finish the show. They ended up bringing in, I think, Mick Napier to finish the show. Maybe it was Rich.
But that wasn't the guy they got from Canada, was he?
Michael Kennard. His name was Michael Kennard.
Okay. So you're 2 weeks in the process. Why did you decide to that this was a good time to leave?
Well, I honestly felt that he wasn't right for the job, and nothing bad against him. I think Michael's a talented guy. It's just he wasn't right for this job. I mean, he had very good writers, and you know that he wasn't connecting with, and he was doing a lot of exercises that were probably good if we were all 5 years earlier in our careers.
Like what kind of stuff?
Very basic stuff. We had our eyes closed a lot, and we're like
walking around in space. Yeah,
walking around is the So I don't know. I just felt like, well, whatever I wanted from this place, whatever drove me to stay here and work so hard to get here, I felt like I had it, and I didn't think that one more ride was going to give me much more. And you know, honestly, what the theater's built on is attrition, I guess, is that the right word? Or turnover, I guess, is the right word, sorry. So that people would, you know, somebody else has to come in here eventually. I didn't want to just stay there forever or anything. So, I just felt like the right thing. But then I was out of a gig. But at the time I was doing a, is it okay if I move forward?
Yeah.
I was doing a show with TJ Shanoff, who I'd met through Second City. And we put up a parody of Fiddler on the Roof called The Roof is on Fiddler. Which was we took Fiddler on the Roof, we made it an hour and 20 minutes long as opposed to 3 hours plus, and we took all the songs and made them into 80s songs, and we put up this weird mashup kind of a show that was really popular at Improv Olympic, and it did really well that summer, and financially you could never do that again, because it was a show we had like 25 people in the cast, which would be impossible to produce now, and you know, everybody's enthusiasm for that and love for the silliness of it. And we also cashed in on the pathos of the original Fiddler, and which is a very, very cool show. And Dick Blasucci from Mad TV came to see that show and had offered me a job after that.
And then...
Because of Stephanie Weir, who was in...
Because of... How...
Well, Stephanie was in Mad TV and said, you got to check out Rich's show at I.O., and he did, and we talked, and... And then at that point, I was like, okay, sure.
And then you end up doing that for how many seasons?
I did season 7, 8, and 9. So three seasons. And, you know, my friend Tammy Sager.
Tammy.
I know. I love her, too. And I had done so much with her at Second City. She was really like my comedy sister. You know, I came up with her. We did a lot of improv shows together. So she was going. Stephanie was there. And I got the sense that they were willing to try more improv kind of stuff. I don't know. I just got the sense that the show was open. And Dick was a Second City guy. So that also was...
Was that an easy decision to make?
Yeah. At the time, I was out of a gig. And I thought, well, this is kind of a soft landing in L.A. You know, I've got a job. And, that's cool, and I can check it out. And you know, there was improv out there, some of course. And
how about this? I'm an actor, not a writer. How'd you?
I don't know. I don't know what happened in those few years. I guess I was just open to trying it. Maybe I had thought better of my other decision, and there really was. It was like a great option versus what. You know, I had done a lot of television commercials and some TV and film stuff here, but you know, there is kind of a glass ceiling with the opportunities that are here in a lot of ways, especially in television and film. And I thought, hey, I'll have an LA chapter. Let's see what that's about. And then I'll move back to upstate New York and apply.
And then you end up going to Saturday Night Live a couple of years later.
Yes.
And I find this so fascinating. It was not a pleasant experience for you.
Overall, yes and no. There were some pleasant things. There were some things that were a little unpleasant. Overall, I'd have to say, you know, I got to play for the Yankees. So that was cool. And I got to do it. I got to be there and see.
But you were a little disillusioned.
In a sense, yes. I also came from a place where I felt like, you know, at Mad TV, I felt like I fell in with a great couple of writers. We kind of teamed up on a lot of stuff. And then I worked hard there. I mean, I really did. And I felt like I had earned the trust of the head writer, of all the department heads. I became friends with them. The actors, we all trusted and liked each other. That's where I met, I met Jordan Peele in Chicago. And Keegan-Michael Key I met in Chicago. But I worked with both of them. And actually, I helped bring Keegan, I didn't help bring him over, but I put in the good word for Keegan and really got Dick Blasucci on Keegan. I was like, you gotta get Keegan. Because he is amazing, and of course they did. So I got to work with those guys. There's just a lot of, like, you know, camaraderie. And then it's like, oh, now I'm the new guy off the bus. Who's this guy? And my script is one of dozens and dozens and dozens of scripts.
But you also had an expectation for the show different than Mad TV.
Meaning, I'm sorry.
That you thought that SNL could have been doing better.
Well, I thought Mad TV could have been doing better, too. I felt like the things that I appreciated in Mad TV were like 1 in 8 sketches I thought were right on. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was a lot of easy stuff that they would approach. As far as the SNL thing, yes. I did feel like when I got to SNL, there was one thing that I thought was going on in the show that I wanted to do differently. And that was that every sketch that I felt like 90% of the sketches I saw took place in the context of television.
Like, here's so-and-so show.
Yes, it's the blank show with blank. And I feel like in the 80s it was, you know, man, blank boy, blank girl. This was, I felt like everything was in television. Whether it was like a presidential address, a parody of Hardball, or just the blank show.
It was straight to the camera is what
yes,
we call it.
A lot of things were in that process. And I am pretty sure this is true. I never, in the 2.5 years I was there, wrote anything in the context of television. So while it doesn't sound like much, it's kind of a pain because the sketches that take place in the course of television are just joke, joke, joke. And the actor just gets to look right in the camera and deliver joke, 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 joke. And I also wrote, I wanted to write scenes, Jimmy, that had every actor possible in it. Because when I was a kid, I loved it when SNL had like, oh my God, they got everybody in this sketch. That made me very happy. Or, like, look, even Dennis Miller's in this. They really need
him. Even if he's a waiter. Yeah.
He was a waiter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, I love it. So I wrote, like, huge group sketches, which for the show is a nightmare.
Right.
It's a nightmare because you have to have, everybody gets their own set of cue cards, and they're color-coded. So if you have two actors, it's like blue and green. You've got 8 actors, there's yellow. You know, there's yellow colored cue cards. Try to see those from across the room. And then if there's blocking, because these are scenes, these aren't straight to camera joke pieces, these are actual scenes, the actors have to constantly be blocking, and all the cue card guys gotta be kind of blocking and running around each other. So, you know, that's potentially part of what I thought, you know, I was doing there, and, you know.
Were you vocal about that?
Not really. I mean, I felt like, no, I don't think I ever really got into that. I never really, like... I know, part of the reason I thought I got along well at Second City was because I never engaged too much with the bosses.
I mean, but you were a sweet kid. I mean...
Thank you, Jimmy.
You were... I remember one time we did something. It was some corporate thing, or maybe it was a workshop. I don't know if I got it or whatever. And a week later, I get a thank you card from you.
Is it really?
That's that? Really, that's, and I was like so impressed. I'm like, here's this guy, he's just from New York, and he, I mean, thoughtful, smart, you know, and Stu Harris, a mutual friend of ours, would always, Rich is such a diplomat, and you were such a diplomat.
Thank you. Shout out to Stu, by the way.
Okay.
Maybe I should have sent more thank you notes. I don't know, and I think a lot of it has to do with just connection and moment, and, you know, there's no shortage of writers there, and there's dozens of them, and, you know, I felt okay about it. Overall, I'm okay with it. I think when I didn't get asked to come back, it's very hard to take. It's very hard to take because it's like, oh, I'm with the Yankees. Oh, I guess I'm not. I guess I'm back in the minor leagues. So that it's very hard to take. But overall, I can't be anything but grateful for the experience to get to go on that ride a little bit. And I was like, I think I lasted a little bit longer than Larry David, so maybe that'll translate.
How do you deal with the rejection?
It's a good question. I guess just time. Time and other experiences.
Do you have like strong feelings? Like when they let you go, you're really angry at them?
Yes, I was. Okay. I was pissed. Yes.
Okay.
I was pissed, yeah.
Okay.
But over time, you know, with other experiences, like I said, you do other things and you realize there's life after high school, mm-hmm. you know. And like I said, I was grateful to get to be a part of it and,
So let's improvise now.
Right, already?
Yeah, yeah, we're getting all ready, yeah. Yeah.
Is the show over?
No, no, we're going to improvise.
Okay.
So,
do we stand up right
now? We're going to stand up in just a second. But we'll get a suggestion, right? What kind of suggestion would you like to take?
Anything.
Okay, could we have a suggestion for...
An eyeball.
An eyeball. Okay, so you hear eyeball. How are you going to approach this?
I already wrote a scene.
Okay, great.
I would start physically. Something that would relate to eyeball. But that I could physically be in the skin of a person. Not playing a concept or a joke, but just playing someone that, you know, I could be with. So I was thinking maybe I could be an eye doctor.
Okay.
Or looking at glasses or something.
So, like, so when you say eye doctor, does it immediately put you into the office?
I was thinking of going to the thing where it's like, see better, see worse. That's where I was.
Okay.
You know, but it could be anything.
Okay, Are we ready to try it?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Take these off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Better? Worse?
The first one was better.
Do the other eye.
Okay.
Better?
Worse? I can't tell the difference.
How's things at the deli?
They're good. My son's covering for me. He says you haven't been in a while.
I cut out meats.
Oh.
All vegetarian. I thought I'm a doctor. I'm not just an eye doctor. I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
I hate when people think of me as just an eye doctor.
Well, that's how we refer you in the deli. We just say just? Yeah. We just say just the eye doctor.
See?
The eye doctor gets pastrami on rye.
The eye is one of the hardest things to... It's got all, you know, the main parts are in an eye?
No, I don't.
It's not slicing meat, I'll tell you
okay.
that.
Okay.
I'm sorry. We talk about you guys here, too.
Sorry about your wife.
Thanks. Are you guys happy together?
Yeah.
All right, try these. These are great. They're a little big, but
yeah. This is just something new.
Well, we'll get the style right, but.
Okay. She said she wanted something that made me look a little younger.
This won't be it.
Right.
She went for you.
Yeah.
You're only 4 years younger than me.
I know.
What do you think's gonna happen in 4 years, Tom? She's gonna leave you for someone else.
Oh, you're just bitter.
I am?
Yeah, you're bitter.
Not just, I am.
Yeah.
Very bitter.
I don't like these. These make me look like Harry Carey. They're really, the frames are too thick.
Do you mean the sportscaster or the event?
The sportscaster.
Okay.
I never heard the event Harry Carey.
Suicide.
Yeah.
Did you mean like, you know what I mean?
I know.
That's just not for the style. That's made to go over any face.
I'm not interested. I want something that has no...
God, you're not... What's wrong with you, man? I'm saying you go out later, you pick out the frames out there. I'm sorry, you're right. I'm bitter about the wife thing. I'm not being professional with you. Well, you can pick out your frames later. That's just for the...
Okay. She says she calls you and you don't call her back.
What am I going to say? It's over.
How about, I'm sorry.
Sorry for what? For her leaving me?
You had an affair too. I know. I saw the receptionist.
Men are supposed to have affairs.
Really?
Yeah. Midlife crisis. But then you get forgiven. And you go back.
I don't see it like that.
Well, you're a meat guy. How could you?
I'm a meat guy?
I guess I look at women like meat.
I think you should call her.
This is a helmet with glasses in it. Just for the look, it's not.
Is the strap optional or do you have to put it on?
Well, whatever you're comfortable with.
Oh my God, this thing weighs a ton, man. Ugh. Who wears these?
Special needs people.
I'm not even gonna ask why you gave this to me.
If the helmet fits. All right, let's say I called her. Let's say I called her, then what?
Just say I'm sorry. Then you can move on with your life. Look, everyone in the deli knows that you've been a mess since this happened.
I wouldn't mind getting a pastrami again. I can't show my face in there.
Well, you call her and then you'll feel good about yourself and you can go in and order a pastrami. To go at first and then work up to actually eating in the restaurant.
Sorry about everything. I've been blind.
Is that Dr. Humor? Is that Eye Doctor Humor?
I was going for it, I guess. Yeah. Well, we'll get you set up. You still want the flip-up sunglasses?
Yeah, I'd like the flip-up sunglasses. Yeah, I'm not interested in the helmet.
I'd like something like this. You know, with a wireless frame. Mm-hmm.
That'd make you look younger.
Yeah.
That's for sure. See more of the face. Open up.
How's that?
Oh, very good. John Lennon.
Yeah. I love the Beatles. Growing up as a kid, yeah. Sue doesn't know anything about the Beatles. You know, she's...
I'm young.
Yeah.
Well, all right, I'll call her.
I think it'd be a good thing.
You son of a gun.
Maybe after you call her, maybe I'd like to invite you over.
This isn't getting into three-way territory, is it?
Well, I was kind of feeling you out. She does speak to you. The last time we had sex, she yelled your name.
Really?
Yeah. She said, Brent, Brent, Brent. I said, no, Stan.
That's possible. We have to get drunk first.
I'm okay with that. I talked to my AA sponsor. He said, you're making this up.
All right, well, why don't you go pick out your frames and I'll start doing some sit-ups.
You're insecure about the way you look?
Yeah, I you look great.
You look great too.
No, you look way better than me.
Don't worry about it.
If we're both going to have sex with Max's wife, I got to look better than you.
Okay.
I like your sense of humor. You know that?
Thank you.
I haven't seen you smile like that for months.
I was mad at you. Took my wife.
Well, I still came here, didn't I? Still got my prescriptions.
We're the only one to take your crappy insurance.
That's not true. I changed insurance company, so I made sure it would cover here. Look, we've been friends since high school. I didn't want anything to ruin our friendship.
I remember the first time I saw you in the cafeteria cutting your ham with a plastic knife. Just practicing.
Yeah.
You can cut it so thin.
Yeah. Yep. And I remember I held it up to one of your eyes, and what did you say?
Better.
Yeah. We had a great time, didn't we?
Yeah. Lot of water under the bridge, huh?
Yep. What does that mean, water under the bridge?
Another way to say time passing.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of time passing. So you'll come over? I'm serious about the three-way. Yeah. I think it'd be good for our relationship.
She's into this? I mean, you've
talked. Yeah, we talked about it.
Or is this your idea?
No, it was my idea. But see, she wanted to go to couples therapy, and I said, let's have a three-way instead. I think it would bring us closer.
All right, yeah, okay.
You don't seem that sure about it.
I want to come over, have dinner, some wine maybe, then see how it goes. Am I going to walk in and it's just going to happen?
Yeah, that's how we've been practicing it. That was so much fun playing with you. How'd you feel about it?
I was a little in my head at times.
In terms of?
Well, I remember there was a moment when you asked me about the wife, and I was realizing that you were asking because you had taken her. And then I thought, oh, that was situationally funny, but I just wanted us to keep relating to each other. And I was just trying to find ways to relate to you. So I think I was just trying not to think about trying to just relate more to you.
So you felt that the wife was going outside of our relationship?
No. I mean, okay. I liked it, but it was like, oh, that was kind of a discovery, I guess, along the way.
Yeah, because I asked you about, I said, I'm sorry about your wife, which I thought was such a great move on your part, saying, acknowledging that I had, because I had no idea that that's where you were going with it. I just thought you looked kind of mopey and sad.
That's just me.
Right. And I thought, well, your wife either died or you got a divorce. But you putting it back to me, I thought was just brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
You know?
But then from there, you have to like, oh, well, now we can play through the relationship with that. Early on, too, I went to like reach to have you sit down. This is physically, which the podcast won't recognize.
Right.
And I also thought that, and I also realized I didn't play enough of that. That there was a little bit, or maybe it factored in, you know, naturally anyway. Yeah, it was fun, Jimmy.
What was it? What?
Well, I think I went to reach for you, and you kind of reached back.
Yes.
As I was leading you to the chair, and I think I was, you know, I mean, obviously that was a move.
Right.
You know, that we were sensing that you were a little like.
Yes.
I don't want to be touched by my eye doctor, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're
communicating. And I'll tell you, I was in my head there because I was going, do you ever do like certain moves? Like a guy touches me and I'm like, I don't want to be touched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's like a bit that I play over and over again.
Oh, okay.
And I kind of was resisting that. What do you think of when you come up against a thing? It's like, oh, I always do that on stage. What's a good way of working through that?
Whoa. Oh, you mean like if you feel like you've done something before?
Yes.
Boy, that's a great question, buddy. I don't know. I guess you just got to kind of take it as it comes and do your best. I don't know if anybody else has experienced this. I feel like I've been in shows, and especially after playing with Craig and Bob for so long, we've done similar
Craig Kikowski
shows
and
Bob Dass.
But you've done, like, you played with them for 20 years.
Yes. Once in a while, I'll be like, is this a show we've done before? A bunch of actors backstage getting ready for a play, and then eventually we see the weird play. Like I just or things like that where you're like, I think this is similar. So you just do your best and try to distinguish. There was a couple impulses I had during our improv scene, too, to just call the wife. But I didn't know if that would be appropriate for our format here. Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, should I just be on the phone with her? Then I can have that scene. Because one of the things I'm sure you know, of course, is that when you're talking about something, you just do it. So if you're saying, you should call her, I was like, oh, I should just boop, boop, and then have that scene.
Right.
Rather than talk about having that scene.
But do you think that's always a hard and fast rule?
No. And again, for this format, I didn't know if it was better to just play out the scene in the office. Or what. So.
You know, it's funny because I found you to be really quick in this scene, and you've admitted before that you don't think yourself as a very quick-witted person.
No. Okay.
All right.
Or maybe I was being too witty and giving not enough. You know what I mean? So sometimes there's that.
The thing I enjoyed, and I was lost a little too, in part. I love that you give room. You know, it's like, here's a line, here's a couple lines, space, line, but not like just for the sake of playing slow. I would imagine this is a conversation that really happened between these two. It sounded very conversational to me. Mm-hmm. What was your feeling?
Yeah, similar. I mean, I say that to players I coach a lot, that, you know, you can use your object work to buy you time if you've run out of something to say. So when I felt like there were those spaces, I was just thinking, well, what would this guy be doing? He might be giving him different things to try on, that kind of thing. And the other thing I say a lot is gifts go where the silences are. So when there's a big space, you just give the other person a gift.
Meaning a verbal gift or a physical gift?
Something, just interacting with them, or just try to hit the ball back to them in some way. I was also resisting, by the way, since we're talking, dissecting the scene, resisting a thing that popped in my head, which was more of a joke, and I didn't do it, which was, how come the first letter on an eye chart is always E? Is that just like a gimme? Do you know what I mean? So I was trying, and I think I was thinking, is this something to approach? And it wasn't, because to me, I kept trying to pull myself back to just relating to you. You know what I mean? Just to play the relationship of you and me. And I liked it. I thought you gave great gifts too. And the fact that we knew each other so long, I thought it was very cool that we'd known each other since high school.
Uh-huh.
Playing into our insecurities about what this three-way may look like.
Right.
horrible three-way.
Right.
The deli guy, the optometrist.
Right.
You know? So I don't know.
Great, so we're going to take some questions from the audience, either about you or about what we just did. So if you could turn the house lights on, that would be great. And if you've got a question for Rich, now is your time. Right here.
I know you're both a writer and improviser, and I was wondering if I could ask you about the difference between finding humor in improv and then finding humor in writing.
Okay, so
well, you know how
where does it come from, you mean?
Yeah.
Not dissimilar places, I think. I think with improv, it's about discovery. There has to be discovery for there to be improvisation. And I often try to keep the players away from writing anything. And in writing, it's not about discovery. It's more about revealing things that you've concocted.
So, going back to that scene, the thing about the E always being the first thing on it, to me that almost seems like a sketch idea versus an improv idea. But both really could work, right?
Yeah, I guess if I was going to couch it, I could couch it in the character that might make it more playable. I've always wondered why the E is the first letter. I mean, who's going to get that wrong? You know, I mean,
right.
I could have done that, but... How valuable was that idea? I think it was something that kind of rose up and I just kind of pushed down.
In that scene, did you approach it as a character? Was the character, I'm a optometrist, or is it, I'm going to the environment first?
Environment first, and then try to figure out who the guy is. I mean, there's when you're in an environment that is known or that you know, that can kind of guide you along as far as behavior. We knew we were in a doctor-patient setting, but we put our own spin on it, I suppose, with the details and specifics. So,
great. Another question? Right here.
Hi, Rich. Hey. Back in your days in Second City, when you guys were doing Paradigm Lost, did you realize at the time it would be as revolutionary and as groundbreaking as it was?
Well, I was not involved in Paradigm Lost, but it was a groundbreaking and revolutionary show.
The show I saw, you were in it.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I may have understudied. So, yes, I am a fan of that show, and I was definitely a big fan.
That was the one with Bill Gates and...
That's when he played Superman.
No, that show was called something else. That was called The Psychopath Not Taken.
And you said that this Superman sketch, which is a classic, can you explain to the audience? Because it's a really funny sketch.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing. Mick Napier was our director for that show, and he invited us all to bring, because you know, you bring in ideas or sketches. You might bring in a page or two with something sketched out on it. You might just bring in an idea, a notion. You might just say, I want to improvise this premise with Jimmy. We're just going to go see what this is about. And Mick said, I want you to bring in something that we would never do here. What is something that has no business being in Second City's stage? Something that would never happen here. And I think out of six of them that got brought in, because Susan Messing brought one in that made it in, and I write dangerous to say to Susan Messing, bring right. it something that does not happen.
So you just see like dead bodies or yeah. animals or something.
And I think out of the six of us that brought stuff in for that, I think three or four of them made it in the final show.
So here's a sketch. It's Christopher Reeve, who was Superman, had that terrible accident, and he was paralyzed.
Yes.
And tell us what the sketch was about.
Well, the sketch starts with a robbery of a bank vault where there's a villain stealing gold with a sidekick. And as they're stealing it, the Superman theme comes on, and Superman rolls out in a wheelchair.
And you're dressed as Superman.
In a wheelchair, yes.
Yeah.
And Superman does not have the ability to physically stop him, but he can try to talk him out of it. So Superman gives this very impassioned plea for the guy to stop, and Mick was very instrumental in this. He wrote a song. Mick wrote the song that was in that sketch, a song that this guy sings, and we took poetic license. Superman stands up out of the chair and talks about his beliefs and hopes for the beauty of the world, and sits back down in the chair and says, there's only one thing between you and this crime. It's your conscience. And I wheel off the stage and, of course, bump the wall on the way out. And I leave, and there's Kevin Dorff and Susan as the criminals. And after a nice long beat, Kevin goes, what the fuck was that all about? And goes right back to robbing. Now, Superman didn't stop them, but he did slow them down enough for the police to get there and take them away. And then I came right back in as Clark Kent in the wheelchair.
But you said that scene did not work. For a long time.
Well, the scene actually started, it might have been in the show before that, Tom, where we had done an improv set, and somebody said something about Christopher Reeve or Superman or something like that as a suggestion, and I think I took one of these bentwood chairs and put it around my neck and kind of like waddled out there to a chorus of boos. And it got such a reaction that I always remembered it, and when Mick said, I want you to bring in something that doesn't belong, I'm like, I want to bring that back. So we put it back up, and I think the first 8 or 12 times we put it up, it got boos, and everybody hated it, did not want anything to do with that sketch. But you know, I learned a lot about running order, and how a running order can protect something, and also context.
Where was that in the running order?
It ended up, I think it was the last scene of the first act. I think this is where it ultimately landed. But, you know, contextual protection, one of Mick's big things is I wrote a lot of stuff with him. He worked on that Second City TV show for a while, too. Mick's, what I think of Mick, I think of, in terms of writing, it's context. That was his thing.
What does he mean by that?
Something that protects... or a frame that protects or presents your idea in a way that the audience can digest it. You know, when you take a headache pill, the shell is not the pill. It's the context for the pill.
So where was the context with the Superman scene?
I think the song helped prop it up. I think just more artfully putting together what crime he was stopping or how he was stopping the crime. All of that, you know what I mean? So... you know, just giving it a way to work, just finding a way to make it work. Ultimately, you can give up on anything at any point, I suppose, but that seemed to be
great. Question here?
Yeah. Can you talk about the writing process or the way the writers on Key & Peele develop the material?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I'd be very happy to. Almost all the writers are improvisers or have had some improv experience. Keegan and Jordan are both improvisers. Ian Roberts, our showrunner, was, of course, one of the founders of the UCB. And Jay Martell has been in comedy for a very long time. He's the other producer. So
Becky Drysdale,
Colton Dunn, and Charlie Sanders is a great improviser from New York. Alex Rubens, I think, also did some improv stuff. So everybody has a base knowledge of improv. So our process, I was not on the show the first year. I joined them in the second season. So I don't know what they did the first year, but I assume it's similar. The process is, as far as presenting the material, we have a morning meeting, which involves the five writers plus the four producers sitting around in a room in the morning, and our writer assistant, James, who is like this mechanical wizard guy. He knows every sketch that's ever occurred on any show, and he was the writer's assistant on Mad TV, too.
So he'll say, that's been done. Yeah. He's like, that's been done. It was Mad TV 1996. It was,
yes. And then he'll... Yeah. Yes, and he has a laptop that he keeps right here on his chest like this, and he's always like, and he'll be searching it, and then he'll go, "That's been done," flip it around and show you the sketch. You're like, "Oh, great!"
So it's annoying and helpful at the same time. Yes.
So, but we come in and everybody, you have an opportunity in the morning. We call it a dookie session, and
dookie
is a word for poo. And there was a sketch called Where My Dookie Go, where these two guys who are sitting on a stoop are just fantasizing about where their dookie goes after they flush it. So, anyway, Charlie Sanders started saying, let's float some dookies out there. And in the morning, we would just kind of float these ideas out. So we call it a duke session. Just some. And then everybody basically has an opportunity to pitch one or two areas they might be thinking about. You're also free to not say anything at all other than just help each other if you already know what you want to write for the day. But you have to write one sketch a day.
Do they come in at 5 o'clock and take your sketch?
No. We get there at 10 in the morning. And I don't know if I'm going to bust this for just the easiest and best schedule ever. And we have a meeting from like 10:30 till noon. Then we have lunch. And then we write from like, you know, noon to 3. And usually people start leaving around 3 or 4 o'clock. But I don't turn it in then. I usually take whatever I've written that afternoon home. And then I have dinner. And then after dinner, I sit down with it again and look at it a few more times and go over it a couple more times. And I turn it in through this like Dropbox system. So as long as they have it by the morning, that's usually fine.
Do you collaborate?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes I've sat down and wrote something for the show and handed it in. And it went on almost like I wrote it. But other times it changed, become very different. So I think that, you know, the key to the success of the show is that we peel. No, I'm kidding. is this improv collaborative process and allowing everything to have a life and go, and also letting things go and not, you know, holding on to things too much. But the other thing I wanted to mention, which I think is very useful to hopefully sketch writers, is that overwriting is what goes on. So we needed 82 sketches for season 3. We wrote 300, and out of those 300, 150, we'll say, got picked. So we had almost twice as much as we needed. The network approved, and they picked, you know, 150. So, you know, there's that story of the pottery teacher that broke his class into two halves. He tells one half of the class, "I want you to make and design the perfect pot." He tells the other half of the class, "I want you to make as many pots as possible in the same amount of time." And the perfect pot is only as good as many of the quickly made pots. So just kind of, if you want to write one great sketch, write 10, and it's going to be in there somewhere. So
have they thought about changing the name to Key and Peele to Perfect Pot?
I've been pitching that.
Okay.
So I just think, you know, a lot of improv. And the other thing was, I wrote a thing for the second season, which was based on a joke idea that, you know, a couple of Middle Eastern guys looking at women walking by would have a very hard time because you can't see anything. So the joke was the women would walk by and they'd be like, "Whoa, I saw some ankle bone. Yeah, I saw a little foot nut right on." You know, that kind of thing. Or like, "Did you see the bridge on that nose? Ah, that's a bridge I'd like to cross," like that. So, because they have nothing to say. But that, so that's the beauty of Keegan and Jordan, because what was not in the script was their seething sexuality starting to express itself with each other. So in the shooting of the sketch, they started like rubbing and touching each other while these women are walking by. And that became a whole other aspect of those characters in that sketch that had nothing to do with me. So, you know, I think having two ace improvisers who are incredibly funny and who are going to look to make things more playful, more funny. The department heads are all amazing. The director is amazing. Our DP is amazing. So,
do you work better when you've got a deadline? or do you work better when you have all the time in the world?
I think it's a good question. I feel like, you know, both give you different things. Sometimes, you know, if you have to write something, you better show up hell or high water, here it is. And sometimes it's just there, sometimes it isn't. But I also don't think there's anything wrong with the other way. You know, I wrote a thing that I did with a friend of mine. It took us like a year to write it. Is that too long to write a script? Or, you know, that year would have went by whether we wrote that or not. So I can do both. I also believe some things you have to let go and they're not there. But yeah, if you have to do it, sometimes, you know, just keep doing it.
Great. We have another question. Yeah, right here.
I would like to know what your favorite character or sketch is that you've ever written, and like some details about it, like how you came up with it, how long it took you to write.
Well, the first thing that came to my mind, I think, is we're on Key and Peele, was a Key and Peele sketch. And this one is called Killing an African Warlord. And it's about a warlord who realizes that he's going to be tortured if he's captured and the troops are closing in on him. So he asks his most trusted soldier to kill him. And the guy grabs a sword and tries to stab him. And he's like, no, no, there's a gun over there. And then the guy gets the gun and it's out of bullets, so he tries to hit him with things. And it's just this very prolonged killing. And it actually started as another sketch where it was going to be like the Spanish-American War or something, and it was just like irrelevant. They weren't going to make it. And then somebody was saying, oh, maybe you can do it with the Coney thing, you know, that warlord. So that became a rewrite of it. And anyway, so it's just like a prolonged killing of a guy. And I got the idea from a film where they were saying to the guy, you know, it was like a soldier asking for his subordinate to kill him. And he had a sword on. I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if he just was like, yes. And start stabbing the guy. It just made me laugh. Like, to think of this is, you ask the biggest idiot in the world to kill you, and he doesn't know how to do it, and he ends up getting tortured anyway.
Now, we had Key and Peele on, I think it was maybe a year ago, and they talked about biracial and how they're really the voice of biracial comedy. They didn't say it, but the critics are picking up on it. What is it like? Because most of the staff, except for one writer, is you're all white, right?
We write the white half.
Okay.
You know, but it doesn't really matter to me what color your skin is. I can have opinions and delve into any topic. Now, maybe I wouldn't come at it the same way as a writer of color would, but I don't know if that makes it something I couldn't write. One thing I wrote was the guy that had to go on after Martin Luther King. So Martin Luther King gives his I Have a Dream speech, and then there's another guy that has to go on after him, and he's like, wasn't that great? And he completely loses the crowd, a riot takes place. So, you know, where does that come from? I mean, it's just like exploring any topic. And in the second season, I think we were hitting things like that. I think we had a thing about Harriet Tubman being a free runner, you know, freeing slaves. So I think it's just thinking in terms of, well, this is an area you could explore. So I don't know, again, I can't speak to it because I am what I am. And, you know, but it's just a matter of finding out what's fun about this area. Or if I was going to write something for Colbert, for example, now, I would be delving in the world of Bill O'Reilly and Fox News, and I'd be trying to look for things in that area. I don't give any thought to Republican politics, Democratic politics at all in my personal life, but could I explore those areas and, you know, write about them?
Would you like to write for the Colbert Show?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, or for example, like Hunter Thompson might have known nothing about motocross, but would write articles about it. So it's like, I don't think you have to be a motocross expert to write about it. I know it does make sense. I mean, John Grisham writes about lawyers because he is one, but does he have to be? I don't think so. You know, whoever wrote Woody Woodpecker wasn't a woodpecker.
So the political stuff you're comfortable with, even though on the Tonight Show it really didn't match with your sensibility.
Well, for me, where I didn't match with the Tonight Show's sensibility was just the tone of the comedy was very different than the tone of comedy I enjoy, and I also like narrative humor. I wrote for the monologue for Jay, and, you know, I wrote a lot of...
What's he really like?
I didn't interact with Jay a ton, but more than none. What can I say about Leno? He was...
I can see how diplomatic you are.
Uh-huh.
Did you like him?
I liked him enough. I thought he...
Did he get you, your sense of humor?
No, not at all. And I don't think that... I think that's generational. You know, at the time, I think I was 38, and he was probably in his early 60s. So I don't know if that has something to do with it. And there are guys that are great joke writers. I was a good joke writer, and I got some jokes on. I felt good about it. But that's not me. That's not my passion. You know, I wrote a lot of... And I tried to write jokes about things that I thought were important to, you know, to get out there. Like, I wrote a lot of jokes about the oil spill. And because I was like, we got to talk about this more. So, that to me felt cool to do. But at the end of the day, I ultimately want to get into films. I want to write and direct films. I want to do more narrative stuff. So, you know, writing those kind of jokes, it's like, there's just so many, and you kind of do it. But there's guys that are so good at it that I would have to write for 20 years to get to where those guys are. Some of the guys I got to work with on that show.
You know, when you were on SNL, there was a story that I'd heard that you had helped... You put Jason Sudeikis in a sketch, and that helped him become a regular player.
I think that sketch was instrumental.
Can you tell us a little your version of it?
Yes, and there was a little bit of a foo-foo-rah that came up when that when that happened. I had written a sketch which was a thing about the Super Bowl shuffle.
And Jason is just a writer at this time, right?
Yes, Jason was a writer, and... he had done a bit where, basically we were going to put some of the writers in the background, because with the Super Bowl shuffle, you need like 600 people. And we said, oh, it's a Chicago thing, we'll put the Chicago writers in the background. So I think Lutz was in there too.
John Lutz, yeah.
And I forget who else was in there. But anyway, so Sudeikis was playing the guy. In the actual Super Bowl shuffle video, there was a guy with a cowbell and a sunglasses, you know, and a hat. So Sudeikis looked like that guy. We're like, oh great, so Sudeikis will be that guy. And and he was doing it, and in the rehearsals, he was killing.
Just with the cowbell.
And just being there, being like a funky guy, right, dancing, and he was just like really, really hitting it, you know? And Tom Brady was playing Jim McMahon, and it was like, you know, whatever it was, and we did like a behind the music, that's what it was, like where they went after that, and they had like albums and breakups and all that kind of stuff, and I think Horatio played Ditka, and it was like, he was just eating chicken wings or whatever, so, I don't know, and Sudeikis, I remember we were backstage watching it, and Lorne Michaels saw Sudeikis doing this, and he like lit up, and he goes, Aykroyd. And I was like, whoa, all right. Now, was that the reason Jason got hired? I don't think so. But I think it was a thing. You know what I mean? It was like a thing where it's like, oh, okay, this guy is a great performer. He's a great performer. I mean, obviously, so.
It seems to me that Key and Peele speaks to your sensibility. Of all the jobs that you've had, would you say that's true?
Yes. Great fit. Love it. Very happy there. And totally feel like they understand me and I understand them. And we have fun writing together. I mean, I wrote stuff with Keegan and Jordan at Mad TV, and we would be up late, like not even thinking about leaving. Like it's way well past 6 o'clock, and we're there in our offices just crying, laughing, having so much fun writing stuff. And a lot of it didn't make it on. I wrote a thing with Keegan and Jordan and Tammy Sager that the four of us wrote. It was one of those late night laughing things, and it's just like it just doesn't connect maybe with the producers, with whatever. So. But yeah, sensibility-wise, I'm
because you did the Frank Caliendo show on TBS.
Yes.
And you actually went to producers and said, this material sucks, basically, right?
I said, I'm not laughing at a lot of what we're doing. And I felt like Caliendo is, to me, I mean, obviously Daryl Hammond's amazing too, but I thought Caliendo is the A-plus premier impressionist of our time. I think he is absolutely brilliant, because he could do George Bush without saying anything. And he's a little chubby guy. He looks nothing like George Bush, but he did. I don't know if anybody else noticed. Anybody else see Frank Caliendo do George Bush? He just puts a look on his face, and you immediately go, oh my God, that's it. And I think his joke was, we have a president who always looks like he's looking into the sun. You know? So, and I felt like the material we were doing, like, Hair Club for Men parodies. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, this is not the material you give this impressionist. So I just felt like we're not going to break the mold with the sketches. And yeah, I did. I talked and I asked to be let out of the show.
For the comedy writers that are listening to this or improvisers who aspire to be comedy writers, is that a good move to go to producers and say, look, I don't, you know, we could do better. If not, I'm leaving.
There was no ultimatum. I just said, I really don't want to be a part of this. So, you know, a good move.
Do you get a reputation for being, you know, oh, this guy, it's got to go, he has a certain sensibility. Do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I couldn't really speak to that, I guess.
Do you care?
I mean, no, because I think anybody that was a reasonable, sensible person wouldn't, you know, if I just said, look, I'm not really enjoying this, I don't really feel like I can contribute here. If somebody thought ill of that, what could I, you know, how can I take that in?
Do you think that us from Chicago sometimes have too high of standards? Because, I mean, we were like in an artist colony, you know?
Yes.
And it's, do you think it works to our disadvantage sometimes?
No, I mean, having high standards, I don't think so. Or wanting the best from yourself and for yourself, I don't think that could have any negative effect in the long run. Because the cool thing about what I feel like I've gotten out of this last 20 years is that I started to look at things in terms of chapters. There could be another chapter. Even with SNL, Joe Kelly, who was hired at the same time as
me. Who's Joe Kelly?
Joe Kelly is a Second City trained guy who went to work for SNL the same time I was there. And I think we were both let go at the same time. And then he went off and wrote for How I Met Your Mother. And then he went back to SNL. You know, and the same kind of thing. Like, I was involved with SNL a couple of times. Like, life is long. I don't think anybody that's in the long game would, you know, things come and go. It's like, you know. So
what is, you're on Key & Peele now, but it's a short, I mean, it's, how many episodes is it?
It's not a lot. We did, I think the first season was 8, and then there were 10, and I think this season there are 12.
Right. So if you, what is the, what would you, the perfect sensibility for Rich Talarico right now in his career?
Sensibility?
In terms of the job. If you could write for any show.
Oh, the show that's out there?
Yeah.
There's a great show called I Hate My Kitchen on Bravo. I don't know, Jimmy. I feel like maybe it would be... I heard they're making a TV show out of Fargo. I guess I'd like to hear more about that kind of a project.
Uh-huh.
I guess... things where I can write scenes, not jokes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Difference between scenes and jokes and narrative-based stuff. So
why does the Colbert job interest you so much?
Just because I do think it's absolutely brilliant, and I don't think it'd be easy jokes. And I'd like to try that. Do you know what I mean? I'd like to at least give it a swing. If it worked out that I was like, no, this isn't quite right for me, I'd totally be fine with that.
Have you talked to him or submitted anything? Or
you know, I actually have. I've submitted a couple of times and have not heard anything.
Really?
Yes. But I'd submit again. It doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean anything.
How does the submitting process work for people that want to know that?
Well, it's different per show. And I often get that question a lot, actually, from friends or acquaintances who want to know more about writing stuff. And a lot of people ask, like, what's in a standard submission? And there is nothing in a standard submission. You know, there is no standard for anything. It depends on the show and the showrunner and the head writers and what they want. You know, so if I'm running my show and I might say, oh, we need this kind of material. You might have your show and say, oh, we need that kind of material. So it really depends.
So do you make a phone call to Tom Purcell or whoever?
You know, you could. If you were going to submit for something, you could reach out like that. But typically you have an agent who's...
So will you go to your agent and say, I want to be submitted for Daily Show, Colbert Report?
Yes, or they will tell you. Okay. They will say, hey, there's a call for writers. That's usually how it goes. And then sometimes, you know, I have a thing that just came up. I might be writing, and I won't mention it because I don't know if it's going to happen or not.
Are you superstitious like that?
No, I just, I guess, I don't know if it's superstition. I just, if it doesn't happen, what's the point of even getting into it? But right. I got a call the other day from two other bosses that I had worked with before. That was like, we're doing this TV special. It's 3 weeks of work. Are you free? So I was like, yes, I'm free. I could do it. So sometimes somebody will just call you and say, do you want to do this? You know, that's what happened with Caliendo. You know, he just said, hey, do you want to come and do this? So it depends on the show. But sometimes you could call. Sometimes your agent will call. Sometimes you'll send something in. So there is no standard, but I'd say for anybody that's trying to get into writing, I'd say just write and put it up anywhere you can. The base for everything is do the work on whatever level you can as best you can. So I do that for myself. So a lot of times I'm in between gigs and I'm home and I gotta write stuff. So it's like, well, I'm just gonna do this as best I can on whatever level I can. If I'm writing something, I'm gonna shoot on my phone. I just do that. So I just try to keep making things, keep doing things, and you know, just keep a flow of work coming in and out. Whether or not I'm getting paid for it, sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. So, yeah.
Rich Tallarico, thank you so much for being my guest. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, as you know. We do not number them because apparently somebody's not good with numbers. We just title them. And this one's entitled The Rich Tallarico Episode. If you want to catch Rich's work, check out Key and Peele Wednesday nights on Comedy Central. And also go to richtallarico.com to check out when he's teaching again. He teaches across the country and performing again. That's richtallarico.com. We also want to thank the good people here at Stage 773 Chicago, our home base, the people who treat us like a rock star. And as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. He's the guy who makes it sound so slick and so professional. You've probably figured this out because I know I have such smart audience listeners, and that is we are on feralaudio.com. We're not alone on feralaudio.com. People like Chelsea Peretti and Todd Berry and Dan Harmon are all on feralaudio.com. It's a podcast collective. And if you're feeling generous, especially as we get closer to the holidays, hit that donate button for Improv Nerd. It all goes to our Improv Nerd Christmas party. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, and my improv blog, which will give you tips to become an even better improviser, go to jimmycorain.com. And if you're interested in having me come to your theater anywhere to do an Improv Nerd and teach a series of workshops, you can contact me directly at jimcorain@gmail.com. And of course, like our Facebook page, it really helps with my low self-esteem. And I want to thank you for listening, because without it, I would just be talking to my cat. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you